Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Tuesday, May 12th. Today we talk about deterrence and security in the Pacific. Top brass from armies in our region are gathered in Waikiki for a conference on land power. We hear from the deputy commander of the United Nations Command about strengthening ties during not one but two major conflicts across the globe. And we talk about dark money. We hear from a liberal think tank that inspired a legislation. It's part of a nationwide effort to curb the influence of dark money in elections. We also learn more about the concerns that the state auditor flagged about the governor's homeless kauhali project. A contractor has failed to report payments to the IRS. And a certain surfing songwriter has a new movie coming out, one that shows us why we're better when we're together. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. This morning, the U.S. Army kicks off a major gathering in Waikiki to talk about land power in what's known as LANPAC. The meeting comes at a time when there are not one but two major conflicts playing out, Russia and Ukraine and the U.S. and Iran, and just before a meeting of two world leaders. President Donald Trump is to meet with China's Xi Jinping. In the spotlight at LANPAC is the United Nations Command here in the Pacific, which marks its 75th anniversary. It was scheduled to be the subject of one of the keynote speeches to open the conference this morning. We got a chance to talk to the deputy commander of the U.S.-led multinational command yesterday. Lieutenant General Scott Winter, who hails from Australia, took over at the beginning of the year. Before that, he was based here in Hawaii. We caught up with him at the East-West Center in advance of the LANPAC sessions with its Pacific military partners from Thailand in Asia to France in Europe. Here's General Winter.
Thank you for this opportunity. It's great to be back in Hawaii. It's one of those places that gets under your skin. And as I said, that both my wife and I are enjoying being back here, albeit that it's under the auspices of a conference. We'll take the opportunity to get outside for sure. But yeah, look, United Nations Command has been in place, you know, since 1950. You know, I think it represents the incredible effort of countries to come together in the face of aggression at that particular point of the Cold War, and was set up as a US-led multinational force, which is still in place today. So does an incredible job and has done for over 75 years now in maintaining the peace and the armistice on the peninsula. And for those who have had the opportunity to visit the Republic of Korea and see the incredible K-culture and the K-pop and everything there, it's been allowed to flourish thanks to that umbrella of security that 18 member states have provided for over 75 years.
And so because you are in Korea now, having spent time in Hawaii, I don't know, what's your sense of how well it's working?
Yeah, I think what that says to me, and being back here in Hawaii for Land Forces Pacific this week, speaks to the centrality of Hawaii to the discussion about security all across the region. And for me, it was an incredible grounding to have the opportunity to spend a couple of years at U.S. Army Pacific before going into United Nations Command, and that interconnectedness that we see with security architecture all across the region. Now, you can't look at anything in isolation. And certainly the importance of Korea to regional security is why so many countries continue to invest in that multinational presence there in Korea.
And I know that, would you say discussions or tensions recently with our allies have been strained. I mean, how much harder does that make your job, given the sensitivity?
Yeah, look, one of the beauties of living in democracies is that there's always going to be those political ups and downs. What I say to people is the importance of reinforcing the military to military relations, which I think are stronger than ever. And this is a time to double down on the importance of alliance structures. So when we have something like United Nations Command, which has been a rock for over 75 years, I think that speaks to the importance of multilateralism and true multilateralism. And the beauty of United Nations Command. It brings such an array of countries together. We have NATO represented countries like Netherlands, Belgium, and France, where I had the opportunity to visit last week. We have regional countries such as Thailand and Philippines and Australia, as well as, of course, being a US-led organisation. And I think that that true breadth of backgrounds and the diversity of thought that comes with these speaks to the strength of multilateralism as a really important part of deterrence.
Was there, or has there been anything that surprised you since you've taken this post?
But surprised and delighted and a little bit humbled by the way in which the Korean people understand the commitment of the countries and the blood and sacrifice of the Korean War. I think often called the Forgotten War by many people, but certainly not forgotten by the Korean people. And I know it's not forgotten by the Hawaiian people as well. And because when you go up to the beautiful Punch Bowl Cemetery up there, it's got so many of the fallen from Korea who are up there as well. So I think there's a very strong connection in terms of sacrifice and understanding between Korea and the Hawaiian people.
Yeah, my father fought in the Korean War, and just knowing the ties throughout the Pacific, important to underscore those relationships.
Yeah, and the Koreans certainly understand that. And we've recently had the privilege of hosting some 75th anniversary commemorations there in Korea. And the beautiful thing has been to hear the stories of the veterans who are brought back by the Korean government, who make the effort to bring those veterans back. And they look at the Korea of today, and that they saw the devastation of 1950 to 1953, and they look at the Republic of Korea today, and their response universally is, it was worth it. And isn't that a beautiful message when you've got veterans who gave up so much, and they go back and they see the incredible culture of Korea today that's been able to grow up under that umbrella of security that's been provided by United Nations Command.
There's concern about the threats that North Korea has made. We've had the missiles launched in the direction of Japan and Guam, and rightly we're a little wary of that relationship and the relationship with Russia and China. And this week our president will be meeting in China this week. I mean, how are you folks looking at that summit?
Yeah, well, what I would say is that where there is dialogue, there is goodness. And I think the importance of providing that sort of multinational presence there opens up those opportunities for dialogue. So I think that's extremely positive. Unfortunately, there is a very dynamic security environment, and we've seen the relationship between North Korea and Russia play out in Ukraine in recent times, and that's of concern. But what I would say is, when you've got 18 different countries of such a background variety united in their determination to secure South Korea from any of those threats, so that's a really powerful message every day, including today.
And for those of us here in the Pacific, we've been watching some of the aggressive positions that the U.S. has taken, whether it's Venezuela or Iran or possibly Cuba, and talks about annexing Greenland, that folks may be worried about what China may do with Taiwan, that if the U.S. can do X, Y, and Z, why can't China take over Taiwan?
Yeah, look, I think we need to get beyond the rhetoric to look at what is being done on the ground. And I look at, the incredible cooperation that I see, the recent exercises have been conducted in the Philippines. We recently conducted exercises, Freedom Shield, in Korea, which again brought all those member states of United Nations Command together. So if you move beyond the day-to-day media rhetoric, you actually see an incredible degree of cooperation at a practical sort of level. So that's why I tend to point to that there's a lot of positives, and the roots of these alliance frameworks are extremely deep. And I think we should, now's the time, I think, to double down on the importance of alliances and coalitions.
Do you have any concern that we've pulled back on soft power?
Look, I see a lot of soft power, and I think Korea is a great example of that. I just came back from a visit to Europe, and it looked like all the vinyl record stores are being taken over by K-pop in that regard. So, look, again, if we get beyond the rhetoric, there's some incredible soft power out there, and a lot of it is coming from places like Korea. So the practical cooperation that continues to occur on the ground, and that not just sort of military to military, but with regards to different projects all across the region, whether that's clean water projects through Southeast Asia, whether that's opportunities for school scholarships that are recently handed out in Korea by a number of the veterans foundations. There is a lot of really good initiatives out there at the ground level. And maybe what we need to be doing is spending more time talking about some of those aspects rather than focusing on some of that more negative rhetoric.
So you're hopeful?
Yeah, look, I'm extremely optimistic because what I see at a practical level, and the example I'll give you, and the recent Freedom Shield exercise in Korea, we're able to bring young men and women out to Korea from 18 different countries. And to see them get to know the Korean culture, make friends amongst those countries, that's my passion, is the opportunity to invest in our young people, get them out, get them seeing the region and the world and the opportunity to exchange ideas, because that's the future. And in that regard, yeah, absolutely, I'm optimistic.
Well, just before heading over to this interview, I just read a story about how I think President of Mexico was asking the K-pop band to add on a few more concerts because the turnout was just incredible and people really wanted to absorb the culture and, have that sharing, but they couldn't.
Yeah, but isn't that great to see the way in which, again, an example of K-pop or soft power influencing a political leader, and because they see the positive impact that has at a community level. And I think that is a great story and one that we should talk about more.
Okay. And then I know that Hawaii depends an awful lot on South Korea for its jet fuel. And I know Australia is having a heck of a time with the petrol, with gas stations running dry. But how are you looking at that whole situation with the pressure on the fuel reserves out in this area?
Yeah, look, it's been interesting that all of us have suddenly taken an interest in learning where our fuel actually comes from. So, maybe in a positive sense, we understand the interreliance, that we have, across the region. But what I'd say is that I think this is now an opportunity for all our countries to look at security more broadly. We need to look at not just through the lens of traditional security, but everything from fuel security, food security, climate security. These are really important conversations that we need to have. But again, looking optimistically, I think we're understanding the opportunities for greater cooperation, between countries regionally, so that we, like we had to do during COVID, that we diversify our various supply chains so that we don't have single points of failure. And I see that being done now. And certainly things are under pressure, but there's reasons, where we can cooperate. I think there's nothing we can't solve.
And then we've got LANPAC this week. I know we've got RIMPAC coming up also this summer. I don't know, any thoughts about how that is being modified at all, given the tensions globally?
Yeah, well, the beauty about LANPAC, and this is now my fifth LANPAC in a row, and while I was stationed here in Hawaii, I had the opportunity of organizing LANPAC. So it's something I'm very passionate about. The beauty of LANPAC is it brings together around 30 different militaries, each of whom has an equal voice. So whether that's Tonga or Papua New Guinea or the United States or France, everyone has that opportunity to have a voice and to discuss. And any opportunities that we have to bring people together for that sort of diverse dialogue and putting everyone equally on the platform to have a voice, I think is incredibly powerful and has never been more important.
Anything else you want to add?
Can I just say, again, what a privilege it was to spend a couple of years serving here in Hawaii. It's now very much my wife and I's second home, and it's great to be back here. And for all the Hawaiian listeners out there, you need to be incredibly proud of the role that Hawaii continues to play as a location to bring people together, which I know it's always been throughout its history.
That was Lieutenant General Scott Winters, who we spoke with yesterday afternoon in advance of the Army's three-day gathering of top military brass from some 30 countries across the globe. The LANPAC summit is taking place at the Sheraton Waikiki Hotel.
Support. support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits committed to helping families of agricultural workers and retirees with affordable housing, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NareitHawaii.com.
On the next Fresh Air, Joanna Stern is not a robot. She's a tech writer who nearly became a robot, spending a year relying on AI to do everything in her life that AI could do for her, like diagnosing her mammogram, responding to messages, folding her t-shirts, and serving as a boyfriend. She'll tell us what she learned about AI's current capabilities. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, for nearly 90 years committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
One of the headlines from the legislative session has been the passage of a Senate bill that would ban so-called dark money. If signed into law, it would make Hawaii the first state in the nation to limit corporate influence in elections. A 2010 Supreme Court decision called Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission found that companies can donate to campaigns, but critics say it sets the stage for shady influence on local and national elections. Take a listen to Senator Jarrett Kioho Kalole last week on the Senate floor before the bill's passage.
Hawaii has a long history of corporations overruling the will of the people. The overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom in 1893 was organized and executed by the sugar companies. The Big Five ruled Hawaii for 50 years before the people ultimately rose up, ran for office, and took over this legislature. And after they did, the people lobbied for statehood, for workers' rights, for healthcare, for environment, and for our families, for things that human beings need and care about. So as elected leaders, we do not serve artificial entities. We serve the people. And now's the time for us to step up again and be the first state in the nation to act for them. Please vote yes. Thank you.
That bill passed unanimously in the Senate last week, and it received a single no vote in the House. State lawmakers credited work by the Center for American Progress for inspiring the new legislation. The center is a liberal think tank founded by Bill Clinton's chief of staff, John Podesta. Tom Moore is senior fellow for democracy policy at the Center for American Progress. Moore spoke with The Conversation's Maddie Bender about the national plan to take down Citizens United. He says once the bill passed in Hawaii, he breathed a sigh of relief. Moore starts with the looming specter of dark money in Hawaii and across the country.
Dark money is corrosive. This is money that is spent independently of parties and independently of candidates by independent spenders. And because of Citizens United and some cases that came after it, it can be spent without any disclosure of who is paying for it. And as long as they're not coordinating with the campaigns, it can, in an unlimited amount, can come from absolute billionaires just dropping it all in one place and having it all spent in one place. And the dark money groups and the super PACs that they work with do provide the most corrosive political communications in our system because they're not accountable at all. Your candidate is going to do all kinds of ads, how they're, here she is with her family and, she's smiling and telling about all the good things that she does. And it is the super PAC and the dark money groups that will fund the horrible hit attacks on the opponent with the, sketchy looking video and, everything looks like a mugshot and the lies and so forth. And just all of that stuff. And nobody's accountable for that. And it is, no matter who's spending it, whether progressives are spending it or conservatives are spending it, that is, it damages people's faith in our democracy because they don't know who's talking to them. They don't know who's trying to buy their elections. They don't know what's going on. And what they really feel more than anything else is that their voice doesn't matter. And that is the most corrosive effect of all of that.
And Citizens United, of course, a landmark Supreme Court case, which essentially paved the way for PAC funding the way that we see in elections now. Citizens United was 16 years ago, and it seems like in the past year, Center for American Progress has really made a push to empower states like Hawaii to pass laws that restrict corporation spending. And so why the timing?
Well, about 2 years ago, I came up with this strategy to do this. And basically, it involves each state just no longer granting the power to Senate politics. It's that simple. It is weirdly simple, and it is weirdly powerful. I worked on it for a year, banging all the wrinkles out of it. The Center for American Progress published my paper on it last September, and that's when things kind of accelerated. And, you know, it has been moving ahead in Montana. An early draft made its way out to a friend in, out in Montana who said, we are going to do this in Montana. So he started on a ballot initiative there. And other folks saw what was going on in Montana and wrote bills in their own states. Robert Reich wrote a couple articles about it, which, and he has quite a following. That caught the attention of some Hawaii lawmakers. And so it's kind of spread kind of organically from the paper that Center for American Progress put out and from what's going on in Montana. We had bills introduced in 14 states this year, and Hawaii was the absolute pleasant surprise that it made it all the way through the process. Those bills did not make it through the process in the other states, which is not a surprise at all. You know, it is a brand new law. No one's ever seen anything like it before. Legislators are kind of frightened easily. So the fact that it didn't make it all the way through all these other states is no surprise. Hawaii is the great and very, very welcome surprise.
And I know you said you spent the better part of a year ironing out the details, making sure that this idea was written in a way that that would hold up. But it seems like the true test, if, well, first we need to wait and see if the governor vetoes it or lets it be codified. And then the test after that are just the legal challenges, potential legal challenges, right?
Absolutely. Some folks have said like, oh, you know, there's a potential. There's, you know, there could be a lawsuit on this. It's like, oh, there's, it's not potential. It is definite. There will absolutely be a lawsuit on this. It is built to withstand litigation, to withstand court scrutiny, to withstand a court's remedies as much as it can be. Because it's not in this regulation space, because it's not banning or regulating or doing any of those things, you know, which kind of like chip away at rights. Courts have all kinds of tools to deal with that. They can just say like, oh, you can't enforce that. You know, so basically, you know, it goes back to the way it was before you passed the law. Because the state is in this power granting mode where it's like, hey, we're defining, we're creating, we're empowering, you know, this is, and we don't have to do any of this. We don't have to have corporations at all in the state. We can set them up however we want. Because you're in that state, it's a very different set of tools that courts have to look at that or to change that if they're not happy with it. You know, if a state gives away powers A, B, and C, and the court says, no, you need to give D also, they can't just pick up a pen and write that into the law. Only a legislature or the people, you know, voting on an initiative, acting as a legislature, can do that. You know, courts hold erasers, not pens. And when you're doing this, when you're in this power granting mode, it's like the legislature is picking up its pen and deciding how to define its corporations. And a court really doesn't have much to say about that in a lot of ways.
But suffice it to say, I mean, there will be legal challenges. And one of the criticisms that this bill has gotten, the one no vote in the House, and then critics have said that this is basically a boondoggle. This is just going to cost Hawaii taxpayers money as the state has to defend itself in court for who knows how long. What's your response?
Well, I think in the floor debate on Friday, it was pointed out that this is what states do. You know, if this is the only way to make progress against dark money after Citizens United, that is what states should be doing. And that is their job in our federal system to press these kinds of things, to be the laboratories of democracy and try innovative things. It could be a little bit expensive for Hawaii if they lose. Yeah, I have not put this forward to lose. This is not a demonstration bill. This is not a messaging bill. This is out there to win. And I think it will.
So let's say this bill is not vetoed. It goes into effect, barring any legal challenges. what difference will Hawaii residents and voters feel?
At the end of the day, what the bill does is assures that every dollar in Hawaii's politics is from a human being, that it's disclosed, and that it was voluntary. And that is a huge improvement from what we have right now. It is still possible that a billionaire could come in and drop a gigantic amount of money into a super PAC, but they can't launder their money through a dark money group first. If they're going to do it, their name has to be attached to it. And for the last 16 years in the Citizens United era, that has not been what we've seen. Mostly very wealthy folks who want to drop their money in politics hide their names through the dark money groups. So it's not clear to me that they're all going to just run over to their checkbooks to write a check that they're going to have to put their name on when it goes out there. But it's gets rid of dark money entirely. And it should allow for folks to work across the aisle more, because there's, in some way, one of the worst things about dark money is not just you could spend a lot of dark money against somebody. It's that you can threaten to spend a lot of dark money against somebody. And then when you do that, you don't even need to raise the money. You could just say it. But that's the kind of threat that has legislators looking over their shoulder and saying, like, look, if I do too much compromising across the aisle here, I'm going to have some dark money funded extremist from either side, going after me in my primary. And so I'm not going to do that. And this takes that out of the equation altogether.
Do you see Hawaii as being, a case study? Do you think we'll see more of this in future years? Will people around the country have their eye on us?
I believe our 50th star will light the way for the rest of the country. If this is signed by the governor and if this is upheld by the courts, I think the day that that happens, or the day that the Supreme Court decides not to grant cert or something along those lines, then every state legislator in the country is going to get 500 calls from their constituents saying, like, I want you to do this now. It is incredibly brave and forward thinking for Hawaii to do this. And it took a huge amount of work among legislators and community activists to get it done. I really think it will pay off. I think it's starting at our westernmost outpost and should wash east as the court decisions come in.
All right. Tom Moore, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Tom Moore of the Center for American Progress and HBR's Maddie Bender. We'll have links to learn more about Senate Bill 2471 on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. There you'll also find a list of seven bills that some say defined the 2026 legislative session.
Support for HPR comes from KTA Superstores, serving the Hawaii Island community since 1916, supporting Kupuna Wellness in its TV show Seniors Living in Paradise. KTASuperstores.com.
Tune in to HPR 2 this Sunday at 3 p.m. when the Hawaii Symphony Orchestra, under the direction of Dane Lam, performs Beethoven's 5th and 8th symphonies. We'll also hear Old Bay, an original work by composer Raymond Yu. That's this Sunday at 3 p.m. on HBR2, your home for classical music, sponsored by the Rice Partnership.
It's being called a scientific and aesthetic breakthrough, the largest ever image of the Milky Way. It shows cosmic gases and dust particles in detail we've never seen before.
So the center of our galaxy is filled with very cold gas and dust that is not visible to the eye, but you can see it very well at millimeter wavelengths.
The hidden chemistry at the heart of the Milky Way. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from Waimea Valley on Oahu, announcing its annual summer concerts beginning June 27th. The series features local musicians, food, and more. Details at waimeavalley.net.
Governor Josh Green and the state auditor have been sparring over the state's Kohali Project. The tiny house initiative aims to help ease the homeless crisis. And millions have been spent on the administration's project. And Auditor Les Kondo flagged some financial irregularities in advance of the audit release. Here with more on the story is Honolulu Civil Beat's Stuart Yurton. Good morning, Stuart.
Good morning, Catherine.
Yeah, so Honolulu Civil Beat did some early reporting on this issue.
Yes, we did some reporting last year looking at some apparent financial oversight by the Department of Human Services and in managing and monitoring its contracts with the main contractor, HomeAid Hawaii, which is building these tiny home villages. And that, in part, prompted the legislature to call in an audit. And as you mentioned, the auditor is looking into it and has said, well, there are some significant problems, and reported that ahead of the audit coming out sometime soon, we assume, but we don't know. In what we looked at was not the relationship between DHS and HomeAid. We were looking at the internal workings of HomeAid.
And so what did you find?
So what we found was a year ago, a contractor a construction manager working on the Kalhali projects went to the governor with a series of allegations saying these projects are being mismanaged. One of them involved contracts between HomeAid CEO and his husband to do landscaping work. We documented that at least some of that work existed, and HomeAid downplayed it and said, well, it's not really a big deal. This is essentially volunteer work or near volunteer work. And yes, the CEO's spouse was paid, but it was very minor. What we found recently is that it was actually very significant. It was a total of about $200,000 paid to the spouse of the CEO through, in some cases, directly to a landscaping company, and in another case, through an intermediary company owned by the spouse's brother.
And then you also had some, concerns were raised by a whistleblower.
Yes, that was a whistleblower who originally brought up these conflicts of interest and said this is a big deal. And HomeAid Hawaii really downplayed it and said not a big deal. Again, what we found recently was, no, there was a lot of money. Again, it was about $87,000 to the landscaping company and another $112,000 or so to an IT company owned by the brother of the spouse, so the brother-in-law of the CEO. And again, this was looking at HomeAid. How did they approve these deals? Did they approve them? These kinds of transactions do need to be looked at by the board of directors, deemed to be fair and reasonable, and then can be approved. There's not a blanket prohibition about these kinds of deals with relatives of insiders, we'll just call them, key employees or officials of the nonprofit. But they do really have to be carefully vetted and assessed. And one of the questions that the story raises is whether these were actually adequately vetted by the board before HomeAid really did the deals.
Mm-hmm.
That is an open question. It's disputed in the story. We have people going back and forth, and people can read that. We can't go into all of that here. What we can say, though, is that it is clear that HomeAid definitely did not report all of these transactions to the IRS as required by the IRS. It wants to know. Yes, maybe you had one of these transactions. Maybe it was fair and reasonable. It was all in the up and up. But you still need to report it and let us take a look at it. And if the transaction existed, we want you to spell it out, explain what it mm-hmm. was. It might be completely okay. But in this case, again, the CEO who signed the tax return said there were no such transactions when the CEO actually had been a beneficiary of at least one or some of these transactions.
And you also checked with some nonprofit experts, and I know they were saying that, there are just certain best practices that need to be upheld, and it looks like possibly that wasn't the case here.
Yeah, there are best practices that need to be upheld. They're mm-hmm. fiduciary duties of trustees, and they're also state law requirements. Again, mm-hmm. it's not just a best practice. These deals, some of these, need to be approved by the board and really looked at by the board under state law.
Right. Well,
of these insider deals.
Yeah. Well, it's a shame because it's a black cloud over an admirable project.
It's a really good project.
But thanks so much.
It is a shame.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Stuart. That was Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton. You can check out his story at civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
A new source of electricity is coming to New York City, powered by Canada.
We export relatively cheap hydro to the U.S. They pay us and they decarbonize, so everyone wins.
I'm Amy Scott, the ins and outs of cleaner energy, next time on Marketplace.
Beginning this evening at 6, following All Things Considered.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Electric, helping residents and businesses be prepared and informed in emergency situations with the Emergency Preparedness Handbook. Download at hawaiianelectric.com/prepare.
But baby, you hardly even notice when I try to show you. Song is meant to keep you doing what you're supposed to. Waking up too early. Maybe we could sleep. Make you banana pancakes. Pretend like it's the weekend.
A new film about musician Jack Johnson hits theaters later this month with the world premiere in Hawaii this Thursday. The documentary is called Surf Film Music. It follows Johnson's journey from surfer to music maker and weaves in his experiences filming the 2000 Malloy Brothers flick Thicker Than Water. The new documentary is an intimate look at Jack Johnson's life and the folks who supported him along the way. Take a listen to part of the trailer.
Jack Johnson, 17, Pipeline, Hawaii.
I think about making things, whether it's music or films. Friendship is the most important part of the whole thing. None of us could have made it on our own. I've always surfed and I've always wanted to surf, so it's this through line through my whole life. Every other creative process kind of waxes and wanes, but I'm surfing through that whole time.
I'd been thinking about making a surfing film for a while.
Chris, he was thinking bigger than I guess I even realized he could at that point. We definitely wanted to get back to the way that old films used to feel.
We both were like, we're making a movie.
You know, that film is a blend of found home video, surf clips, and live touring footage. Johnson spoke with HPR's Kevin Allen about how he's feeling about the upcoming release.
I'm excited about the film and it's fun, but it's also nerve-wracking to have a film coming out that's kind of based around yourself. It really started with these little clips. Like, they were almost like these little social media clips that we were making that we was going to be for promoting the old surf films. Like, we were deciding to put our old surf films, Thicker Than Water and September Sessions, which had been on VHS back in the day, and then eventually DVD was the new big thing. And then when everything was transitioning over to online and streaming and stuff, it was during the time my music career started happening, and we just kind of always slept on getting that done. And then we kind of like had to re-clear all the songs at some point, and it was like, you know, a process, and we kept putting it off. We finally were going to put these old surf movies back out, and the exercise was, oh, let's go through the old footage and find some cool stuff that'll be these little clips. And that's how it started. Then when we started putting the little clips next to each other, it started telling this bigger story. And right around the same time, I found this footage. My uncle, Skill Johnson, I grew up right next door to him. And he was the neighborhood magician when we were kids, Skilly Skillo. he had all this footage of my family, he would always tell me, but he didn't have it transferred. And so we finally got all this footage. He told me, he's like, you're going to find this footage and there'll be some shots of you here and there, but there's also going to be like lots of shots of Pipeline, Haleiwa and Sunset of people surfing. And it was like 30 hours of footage. And every once in a while you'd see like a little shot of like me, cause he'd literally be filming the waves and he would like turn the camera over at me and my diapers in the yard, like walking around or something. And so we found all this footage, literally has like the first steps I ever took and my mom catching me. At my age, like we don't usually have that stuff. It was like really crazy to find that we had that footage. So anyways, that part kind of got added to the front and it just grew into a full length film, which was a strange process. But even though I'm the through line, I guess the reason I decided to follow through, it feels like, to me, it's like a story about friendship and about making things and collaboration. Felt like the bigger story to tell there.
Yeah, and it's interesting, too, that you bring that up, because in the movie, you kind of talk about how, you know, watching old footage, sometimes it can take on new meanings when you watch right. it later in life. I guess, were there any moments for you when you're reviewing some of that old footage, you know, where you kind of had a similar revelation, I guess, where you saw it and it meant something more to you maybe now?
Yeah, the big thing, I mean, a lot of people from the surf world know Tamayo Perry, because he was such like a just a fun human to be around, and a lot of people have traveled with him. And it's, we lost Tamayo a couple of years ago, and you know, he was just one of those like so full of life humans. And so finding old footage of him was a big part of why the project got finished. He was on the very first trip we ever did to these remote islands, and he was the first one to paddle across the channel on the very first day that we started shooting the movie Thicker Than Water. And so to like see that old footage, and then as we started going through these rolls of film that, you know, you end up editing little parts into the final piece, but there's all these rolls that we'd watch through, and we kept finding these shots of Tamayo, like just with the silliest faces and like always sticking his tongue out, always throwing shotgun. Like we kept trying to explain to him like, hey, Tamayo, like our goal here is we're trying to make something kind of cinematic. So like, if you see me with the camera coming across and doing a slow pan, and you guys are like looking out at the sunset, just keep doing what you're doing. And he couldn't not stick his tongue out at the camera and stuff. And so, no, he couldn't help himself. So like, as we found all that stuff, even though none of it was in the film, that becomes like one of my favorite parts of this new documentary, is making this little montage of Tamayo's, you know, silly faces and like pissing me off behind the camera. So, you know, stuff like that, like going through and getting to see all these shots of like one of your best friends from back when you're younger. It's just, yeah, it was so special. And like, that's been really fun.
Yeah. And it's funny that it's a documentary about you, because after watching it, I felt like almost half the movie was about the people that you love.
Right. That's cool. And
almost more so. What was their impact, you know, your community, the Molloys, you know, Kelly, Tamayo, I guess, how did all of their influences kind of touch you and sort of make you the man you are today, and also make this film what it is?
There's some that are real obvious to me, like G Love, Garrett Dutton, who's from the band G Love and Special Sauce. He's in the film, and Ben Harper, and both those guys are real obvious. Like, if I didn't have either of those guys, I would have never had a music career. They both just like saw something in me before I knew that it was there and really took me under their wing and kind of, you know, Garrett took me into the studio the first time I was ever in a real studio and put me on his album. And then Ben Harper took me on tour before I'd ever been on tour. I remember he asked me, you want to come out on tour with me? And at that point, I'd only played like a handful of shows in little clubs on the West Coast of California. And I remember telling him, like, I don't think I'm ready. But he'd be like, oh, it doesn't matter. He's like, I'm the one who gets to choose. Like, it's my shows. And like, I think you're ready. And then there's, you know, you just go back and Chris Molloy, like making Thicker Than Water. At that point, I was really excited to do camera work, but I never really even dreamed big enough to think that we could make our own film in our mid-20s all the way through on 16 millimeter film. And Chris was the one kind of dreaming that big and convincing our little friend group that we could do this. And so, yeah, the more I thought back about it and the more I kind of watched the old footage, that was the story in it. It's like when friends see things in you before you can see them in yourself. So that was like a theme that kind of ran through it as well.
Yeah, and one friend who seemed to see a lot in you was Kelly Slater. And I really love that there's a section where you guys are just jamming. And, you know, you're talking about how Kelly's teaching you some stuff and you're teaching Kelly some stuff. And I think for like a lot of musicians and people who play an instrument kind of coming up, that's like one of the most instrumental steps in learning is like, oh, you've got a friend who's like kind of into it too, and you're just like bouncing off each other. Describe to me that relationship between you two and just kind of maybe how it helped you grow as a musician or as a person.
Yeah, Kelly and I mean, our friendship kind of is similar today. I think that, you know, he's now at a point where he's not on tour anymore and his life's probably getting less competitive, but he's been competing on such a high level for so much of his life that music was always kind of an escape for him. There's no competition, it's collaboration. And I was kind of, as a teenager, the one, me and him were learning around the same time. And I think it just was like a way for him to sometimes be in a space where nobody wanted anything from him and nobody was like, he didn't have to try to like better anybody. And, you know, he had so much of that in his life. So anyways, our friendship was based around learning things and creating things together. It was, yeah, that was a fun time. And so Kelly's an interesting guy. Like, he really loves design. He's really interested in like paper airplanes. His fun fact about Kelly is like, he constantly will be sending me like little things about like new ways to build paper airplanes.
What?
And, yeah, he's really into paper
airplanes. What are you talking about?
So he's really creative. And he gets, you know, people always talk about how competitive he is and stuff. But I think a lot of his success has come from creativity and being able to always be like creative enough to keep thinking about how he improves in the surf world for that long. And anyways, our friendship was always based on creativity, which is a lot of fun. And so even though it's like celebrating the past, new things grew out of the film, which is friendships, new friendships and new music and a new relationship where I'm going on the road this summer with those guys and touring together. And we just really love hanging out. And so I guess, yeah, whenever you jump into a new creative process, it's good to have an open mind and just see what comes out of it. Because I wouldn't have dreamed that getting to jam with those guys was going to be part of the process. But that ended up being like one of my favorite things is that relationship.
Yeah. And throughout the movie, a lot of the surfing footage and your own music really do go hand in hand together. And it's a, you know, kind of a great reminder that those two elements, surfing and music, are just so intrinsic in one another. You know, some of my favorite surf flicks, it's half the time it's because of the soundtrack.
Yeah.
And I love the way that surfing and music can really combine into just one art form.
Yeah.
Was that a big influence for you, I guess?
So the film's called Surf Film Music, kind of all blended into one thing. It was just a fun little gimmick where we realized the F from surf could be the F for film, and then the M from film could be music. So we blended, mashed it. I guess like symbolically, they kind of all blend in my life, and it's the blending of that. But the term surf film music has a few things for us, as we discussed it too, is the three parts of the film. But it's also like growing up, everything that informed me were surf films. So like, I guess my genre of music is kind of surf film music. It's when I was watching old Jack McCoy films growing up, or like Ticket to Ride, or like all these films when I was a kid, whatever the music was in that film, those were the albums I was going to go out and buy. Like, I got turned on to TSOL or Agent Orange and like all these bands that I was like trying to play their songs eventually. Like, the songs I was learning to play as a teenager were the songs in surf films. So surf films definitely like shaped my style of music. And then later in life, I found myself writing music for the films. And then later in life, I found myself making albums that were all written while I was on surf film trips. You know, like the images from the surf films were informing the lyrics that were on Brushfire Fairy Tales and on. Like, I wrote most of those songs on surf trips. And so anyways, that had a lot of meaning for us, the surf film music thing, even though it was a fun little gimmick of the blend.
It's a good gimmick, though, when it transitioned between surf to film and then film to music. It's good luck that all those words just perfectly lined up together like that, for sure. I don't want to give too much of the movie away. I really do think it's a fantastic movie that people should go out and see. But there's a certain moment where a green board makes a reappearance. Oh, yeah. And, you know, that's when you got really a lot of famous guys who are now even more famous to ride in the film Thicker Than Water, which, you know, the movie follows you making. And then 20 plus years later, you have guys coming back again to ride that same board. What was it like coming back and doing that section again after 20 plus years? I mean, that must have been quite a trip.
The green board, yeah, like you said, Thicker Than Water, the idea was that all these best surfers in the world would ride this funky little single fin. And it wasn't so much about the performance. It was about seeing this connection between all these surfers and seeing how they would interpret this board that's not their normal type of board. Like, how do they interpret it? And you get to kind of see people's style stand out, because sometimes, like, when you're thrown off your game, that's when style becomes real apparent. And then we found out we still had the board. It had been under somebody's house for a long time. And really, that was probably the beginning of the film starting to come together. It was not thinking of it as a film at that point. We were like, oh, let's get people riding the green board again for fun. That'll be a fun little thing to have. And so besides the ones that are in the film, like I think Stephanie Gilmore and Coco Ho have a ride in there, John, and we have so many other people riding the board. We have like, we could make a whole another little section, which I'm excited to do at some point about the green board. But it was kind of the thing that brought me and Chris and Emmett together. Chris got the board and a board bag and he came over to Hawaii and we just kind of like did one interview about the green board. And then we just found ourselves in this conversation starting to talk about other old fun memories. And I think that green board little section became like where the film kind of grew back out of, is like getting back together and having this artifact from the old films was the beginning of that collaboration getting reunited.
And to me, it's kind of like the clearest point where I think for a lot of people who surf and maybe are creative and live lives where they go down different paths, surfing is always like a really clear thread in a lot of people's lives where it's something that's, you know, you're always kind of doing, it's this persistent obsession with waves and riding them that I think a lot of surfers have. So really looking back at this film and kind of your life, what does surfing really mean to you now? How has surfing maybe been like redefined, or what is your definition of it now?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, it's still all those little things. It's still just the thing you do to have a fun time or to spend time with your friends. Like sometimes I'll see an old friend out in the lineup and the waves aren't that good, but I'm like, oh, I haven't seen him for a few months. I'm going to paddle out and just go hang out. And it's the spot. It's like your kind of spot where you just get to hang with friends. It helps me keep my sanity, I guess, because like my wife, if I start getting kind of like cranky or short on tour or you know, just around the house, where she'd be like, you need to go surfing, you know, because it's like a reset button for me. So it's all those little simple things. It's also like the way I connect with my dad, who's not on earth anymore. I lost him like 15 years ago, but every time I'm in the water, I feel closest to him. So it's like a spiritual thing for me as well. It's like the place to kind of meditate and connect with people who aren't with us anymore. It's kind of like all those things from the most like mundane, simple day-to-day, just go have fun with your daughter, all the way up to like visiting your pops. You know, it's like everything.
And that was musician Jack Johnson and HPR's Kevin Allen talking about the upcoming debut of his documentary Surf Film Music. Johnson will be releasing a companion album this Friday. You can catch the documentary along with a talk story and acoustic performance at the Blaisdell Concert Hall on May 14th and 15th. The film hits theaters later this month. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I'll find with everyone. We'll sing and dance to Mother Nature's song. This world keeps spinning and there's no time to waste. Well, that's a wrap. Tomorrow, we plan to hear about hurricane preparedness. A strong El Nino may bring an uptick in severe weather this summer. Got questions about what to expect and how to prepare? Look what happened with the Kona low storms. Call our talk back line, email us, or reach out on social media. You can find the conversation on our website or as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.